This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Levitt knows about the problems a writer can run into when his fiction is based on his life and friends and family feel their secrets have been betrayed. It's something the main character in Levitt's latest novel learns, too. The novel is called Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing. It's just been published in paperback. It's about a young writer trying to break into print while supporting himself at a publishing house where he's assigned to read through the slush pile. He's also trying to figure out how to come out of the closet. David Levitt's first book, a collection of short stories, was published in 1984 when he was 23 and was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Penn Faulkner Prize. Now with several books and a couple of major writing controversies under his belt, he's a professor guiding young writers. Levitt's novel begins when the main character, Martin Bauman, is in college, taking Professor Stanley Flint's famous seminar, The Art of Writing Fiction. Flint is a professor who cultivates an aura of mystic authority. I spoke with David Levitt last fall when the novel was published in hardcover. We started with a short reading.
Flint's seminar, to say the least, had a different rhythm. It worked like this. At the beginning of each session, a student would be asked to read aloud from his or her work. The student would then read one sentence. If Flint liked the sentence, the student would be allowed to continue. If he did not, however, and this was much more common, the student would be cut off, shut up, sent to the corner. A torrent of eloquence would follow, the ineffectuality of this slight undergraduate effort providing an occasion for Flint to hold forth dazzlingly and about anything at all. His most common complaint was that the sentence amounted to baby talk or throat clearing, this latter accusation almost invariably followed by the invocation, "Remember Flint's first principle," and from us, the responsorial chant, "Get on with it." Soon we understood that Flint loathed boyfriend stories, stories in which the protagonist was a writer, stories set in restaurants or cocktail lounges. To cocktail lounges, he showed a particular aversion. Any story set in a cocktail lounge would provoke from him a wail of lamentation, delivered in a voice both stentorian and grave, a sermonizer's voice, for the truth was, there was something deeply ministerial about Flint. Meanwhile, the student whose timid words had provoked this outpouring would have no choice but to sit and percolate, humiliated, occasionally letting out little gasps of self-defense, which Flint would immediately quash. An atmosphere of hyperventilation ensued. The windows steamed. Those Flint had maligned stared at him, choking on the sentences in which, a moment earlier, they had taken such pride, and which he was now shoving back down their throats. Yet when, on occasion, he did like a sentence, or even more rarely, when he allowed a student to move from the first sentence to the second, or from the second to the third, it was as if a window had been thrown open, emitting a breath of air into the churning humidity of that room, and yet a breath that would cool the face of the chosen student only, bathing him or her in the delightful breeze of laudation, while outside its influence the rest of us sweltered, wiping our noses, mopping our brows.
A lot of people figure that the teacher in this novel is based on Gordon Lish, the writer, editor, and teacher who was one of your teachers at Yale. Mm-hmm. Assuming that you had someone, Gordon Lish or someone else in your life, who had, as you describe it, an aura of mystic authority.
Uh-huh.
I wonder what impact that had on you as a young, growing writer. You know, I could see how you'd really become a praise junkie in a situation like that, where criticism was the equivalent of humiliation, because you weren't allowed to read any further if you didn't like the first sentence, and praise was elevated to like bowing before you in praise. I don't know. It could really turn you into a manic depressive or a praise junkie.
Well, I love that term, praise junkie. I've never heard that before, but I think it's perfect. The thing about me and to a great degree about Martin Bauman, who is sort of my alter ego in this book, is that I think I was a praise junkie long before I ever started taking writing classes. That was something that was really endemic to my character from very early on. But certainly the habit of being a praise junkie probably meant that I was particularly attracted to teachers of this sort, which I think a lot of people are, because a teacher like this really makes you feel that his or her praise means something. At the same time, I have to applaud the kind of teacher that Stanley Flint is for instilling in his students an extremely high standard and making them feel that they're always striving to achieve that standard, and that once they've achieved it, the bar goes higher. So there's always something more to achieve. And I think that that's very healthy for a writer. When you become too complacent or too sure of yourself, it seems to me your writing usually suffers. Whereas if you're constantly trying to do something that you feel you can't do, your writing grows.
If you have the strength to withstand that kind of criticism, which not everybody mm-hmm. does, did you?
Oh, yes. I'm pretty tough. I'm very thick-skinned when it comes to criticism. I mean, which doesn't mean that it doesn't.
How can you be so thick-skinned and a praise junkie at the same time?
Well, let's put it this way. I've always been a praise junkie, but I've become thick-skinned over the years because I've had to. Martin is not only a praise junkie, he's also avidly in love with the idea of being a writer. And he does have very high standards for himself, and he does want to be the best writer he can be. And that, in a funny way, militates against the praise junkie in him. There's a point in the book in which I talk about this, and I discuss about how the fact that in every writer there are really two beings. On the one hand, there's the artist who works in isolation. And on the other hand, there is the professional who is both his enabler but at the same time his enemy, because what the professional has to do goes against the very nature of what the writer has to do. And yet the two need each other even though they're constantly in conflict.
How are they at odds?
They're at odds because writing is such a deeply private process. You sit alone in a room and create, and you dig things out of very private parts of yourself that in an ordinary situation you would never have to expose. Writing fiction is a process of self-excavation to a great degree. Well, then when you publish a book, you're suddenly taken out of the situation of an almost artificial privacy and thrust into exactly the opposite situation. You're suddenly in the public limelight. And even though you can tell yourself 1,000 times it isn't me, it's the book, at the same time, the book comes out of you. And so you naturally feel a very personal sense of identification with it. And when you think about it, those are very opposing impulses. And it's tricky to manage to be both those people at the same time, especially because there's something about the process of having to sell yourself, which every writer obviously has to do, that goes very much against the grain of writing from an artistic impulse.
I want to get back to the teacher in your novel, Stanley yeah. Flint. He's somebody who's full of like principles that young writers should follow and everything. And his second mm-hmm. principle is to perceive something one had gone through as particular or special was to commit not merely an error but a sin against art. He wanted writers to articulate the commonality that binds us all.
Yes.
Talk to us more about this principle and whether you agree with it or not, whether you think it's good advice.
Well, I'm not really
given to having principles.
Well, no, I mean I have principles, but I'm not very pronouncy.
yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah.
By comparison to Stanley Flint. However, I do think it is true, particularly in the age we're living in now, that writers need to remember that fiction is about making an experience accessible to someone who hasn't had it necessarily. And since we're living in an age where if you go into a bookstore, you'll see literature or fiction subdivided by all kinds of ethnic and sexual divisions. For example, the Borders I was in recently, where I found that my books were under gay and lesbian literature, but not under just literature. And then there was another section for black literature, and I noticed that Toni Morrison was there, but she wasn't under literature. When you're in a world which is so inclined to compartmentalize, I think it's very important to remember that the whole point of literature is to move beyond the particulars. The particulars are important, but so is the common ground that underlies them.
Another bit of criticism that the teacher in this novel passes on to the student, your alter ego, is this. And this is about a story that the teacher has read of the students. The trouble was it read like a public service announcement. Also, you write as if homosexuality itself was interesting. It's not interesting. All that's interesting is individual experience. What does the teacher mean here, and what do you think of the advice?
Good advice. I would give it to a student. I think what the teacher means is that for fiction to come alive, for fiction to really mean something to a reader, it has to describe lived experience, lived human experience. And one of the problems, I think, with a lot of so-called gay fiction, particularly in the late 70s and early 80s, was that there lay behind it a kind of propagandistic impulse or a political impulse, the impulse being to somehow further a cause, to make the cause being or the purpose being to make the lives of homosexuals more publicly known or to portray homosexual men, particularly in a more positive light, which is a noble idea, but one that runs completely contrary to the essence of fiction, which again is always about individual experience. And when I look at my literary heroes and heroines, the writers I admire the most, what distinguishes them is the degree to which they seem to move beyond both genre and propaganda. If you look at a novel like Howard's End by Ann Forster, which is one of my favorite novels, there's a deeply political and somewhat subversive subtext to that novel that has to do with the destruction of a certain way of life by technology. And yet on another level, this is simply a story about the lives of human beings who interact and whose motives clash. And the novel works very well on both levels. You have to have both levels, though. Otherwise, you'll have what is more like a board game with the characters functioning as pieces in a kind of plot that has a moral or political purpose. And that's not fiction, that's propaganda.
My guest is writer David Levitt. His latest novel is called Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with David Levitt. His novel Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing, has just been published in paperback. Your character publishes his first story in a magazine, and that first story is about him coming out to his parents. And he imagines himself saying to his parents, "Mom, Dad, guess what? I'm coming out in the magazine."
Mm-hmm.
Now, the first story you published in The New Yorker was a story about a gay character.
Yes.
Did your parents already know you were gay, or was that part of your coming out?
All that happened more or less exactly as it happens to Martin in the book. It was the sort of double whammy, and we were talking earlier about the idea of being a praise junkie. In some ways, I think I hoped to temper what I feared they would perceive as a piece of disappointing news by offering it in tandem with a piece of news that they couldn't help but be excited by, which was that I was publishing a story in The New Yorker. And that seemed to me a strategy that is probably very typical for young gay men and lesbians to try to achieve in order to compensate for what they fear will be a great disappointment to their parents.
Let me just point out about something about how you might have played your cards wrong here, because you're basically saying, "Mom, Dad, I'm coming out. The good news is I'm getting published in the magazine, but the bad news is now the whole world is going to know."
Uh-huh.
And it's probably like the last thing in the world they wanted the whole world to know while they were first absorbing it.
But in a funny way, that it was necessary for me at that point to tell the whole world and not merely to tell them. But you're right. I think it came as a real shock, because it meant that something they might otherwise have boasted about to their friends became a lot more complex.
Yeah.
And this was all years ago. And now, you know, with my father, we laugh about this because it seems so much a part of the past. But at the time, it was, you know, a big deal.
So did they brag to friends that you were in The New Yorker, or was that something they tried not to talk about?
Well, actually, this is yet another instance in which the novel digresses from or diverges from reality. I had told them that I had a story coming out in The New Yorker long before I told them that I was gay. So they had already started boasting to their friends. Subsequently, I came home and told them what the story was about, and they had to sort of double back to compensate or to sort of alert their friends to what was going on. And yet that didn't seem to me, this is an example of how sometimes reality just doesn't work in a novel. It can start be the jumping off point for the novel, but it isn't necessarily the best way to handle something in a novel.
Oh, great. Now tell me why that wouldn't have worked in your novel and how you changed it in the novel.
Well, I'll tell you, I think it wouldn't have worked in the novel because, even though it was true, I found it hard. I wasn't convinced that readers would be persuaded that Martin would have, that Martin's mother would never have asked him what the story was about, which is what happened to me. I said, Mom, I'm publishing a story in the New Yorker. My mother never asked me what the story was about. Now, if I tell you that that really happened, you'll believe me, though you might, I would imagine, be surprised, because what mother isn't going to ask that question, I would think. And yet I felt that I couldn't get away with that in a novel because it strained credibility too much. And so I reconfigured it so that Martin wouldn't actually tell them that he was coming out until he had a story coming out in the magazine, until he also at the same moment told them that he was gay. The other reason I did that was because I wanted to end the chapter with the line, Mom, Dad, I'm coming out in the magazine.
So why do you think your mother didn't ask you?
Because I think my mother probably on some level guessed.
Okay.
And didn't want to know.
Right. Anybody who, like you, writes fiction that is based somewhat on autobiography and on the experiences of people mm-hmm. who are close to you risks hurting or offending those people who are close to you, because they might read something that seems like it's based on something that really happened to them, and either they interpret the incident differently, or they're insulted about the way you've characterized them, or they feel that you've betrayed a secret of theirs. How have you dealt with that as a writer? Has that been a problem for you?
I consider it an occupational hazard. And it's been a problem for me to some degree. And yet, I've got to say, in all honesty, I have been written about. I have been the subject of fiction. So I've stood on both sides of this fence. And it seems to me, especially when the people in question are also writers, it's very important to remember that no matter how upset we may be by what other people write about us, if we start yelling and screaming about it, we're threatening the very freedom on which our own creative lives depend. The other thing I want to say about this, which I think is really important, is that I think any serious writer is writing for the future, not for the present.
Mm-hmm.
And these kinds of issues are relevant only for a very short time. And it seemed to me that it would be a great artistic mistake to hold back on something for fear of hurting someone in the short run, which doesn't mean that you should go and write something that's sadistic or cruel, but I think you really will hurt yourself as a writer if you leave out some aspect of your own experience simply for the sake of not wanting to offend someone else who was part of that experience. And the thing to remember, of course, is that human experience, no one owns human experience. If you and I have a conversation, it belongs to both of us. And I think it belongs to both of us in an artistic sense as well. And we both have the right to write about it, which is why I would never, ever voice an objection to anyone writing anything about me, no matter how much I personally disliked it, no matter how much I was hurt or offended by it.
Well, have you been hurt or offended by things people have written about you?
Oh, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Many times.
Name something.
Both fiction and journalism. Well, my an ex of mine wrote a short story about a character who was very clearly based on me that was published in an anthology a few years ago
mm-hmm.
that I was quite, I would say I was wounded by.
What was wounding about it?
What was wounding about it was that it seemed to me personally unjust. However, I realized that that was irrelevant to the story's value as literature. Whether I personally considered it unjust was a little bit like what, I mean, it ties into what Stanley Flint says at the end. Do you really think I'm, when he quotes Beethoven as saying, do you really think I'm worrying about your miserable fiddle when I compose? Feelings of something being unjust, feeling of something being unfair, that's the miserable fiddle. And what matters is not the fiddle. What matters is the composition. And I will allow that story, no matter what I might have felt about it personally, has every right to exist and every right to remain in the arena of literature, because finally I was just the jumping off point for it.
Well, David Levitt, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure as always.
David Levitt recorded last fall after the publication of his novel Martin Bauman, or A Sure Thing. It's just been published in paperback. Levitt also has a new collection of short stories called The Marble Quilt. This is Fresh Air.